Thank you, Brian. And thanks very much to the organizers for putting this conference together and giving me the opportunity to tell you about von Neumann algebras and GT gravity with matter. So this talk is going to be based on a paper I wrote earlier this year, which follows on to some work that was also put out by Pennington and Witten earlier this year. So just to get started to introduce the subject, I will ask, what is a von Neumann algebra and why is it relevant for people who care about quantum gravity? So as you heard in the previous talk, a von Neumann algebra is a star algebra of bounded operators that equals its double commutant. So if A is an algebra, we say that its commutant is given by A prime. The commutant is just the algebra of all bounded operators that commutes with A. And the double commutant, or the commutant of the commutant, is A double prime. And the defining equation, if you will, for a von Neumann algebra is just A equals A double prime. So mathematically, that's what a von Neumann algebra is. So physically, a von Neumann algebra is basically, you know, a model of a subsystem of a quantum system. And for, you know, topics of relevance to, you know, ADS-CFT and quantum gravity and holography, a subsystem of interest for us will be the entanglement wedge. So an early application of von Neumann algebras to quantum gravity was given in this 2016 paper by Daniel Harlow, where in this case he studied finite dimensional quantum error correcting codes as a toy model for ADS-CFT. And in the example he studied in that paper, the entanglement wedge was treated as a type 1 von Neumann algebra. By definition, a type 1 von Neumann algebra induces the following decomposition of the Hilbert space. Here I have in mind the bulk Hilbert space. And so this is the decomposition, and then the algebra is defined to be the algebra of all operators that acts on, say, just the right tensor factor in each of these superselection sectors. And this was the model, the mathematical model for the entanglement wedge in that setup. So today I'm going to tell you about a different toy model of ADS-CFT, namely JT gravity with matter. And instead of type 1 algebras, I'm going to show that the entanglement wedges in this case are modeled by type 2 infinity factors. And just as in the story that Daniel gave us in 2016, these von Neumann algebras will give us a natural language for understanding bulk emergence. So that's one of the messages I kind of want to convey in this talk. A second message I want to convey in this talk is that von Neumann algebras are capable of putting the replica trick on completely firm conceptual ground. So you don't have to think about subtleties that arise when analytically continuing, you know, from an integer to a non-integer. This is all taken care of very nicely by von Neumann algebras, as I hope you will see. Okay, so let me describe the model a bit. So our interest is going to be in JT gravity, minimally coupled to matter, which is known to be basically an effective low-energy description of the SYK model. So here's the Euclidean action that we're interested in. This first term is a topological term. Chi is the Euler characteristic of the Euclidean manifold, the Euclidean 2 manifold that we're studying. And S0 is a parameter. It's called the zero temperature entropy. I'm going to forget about this parameter in almost all of the talk, but then come back to it a little bit at the end. Here's the standard action for JT gravity. The most important feature of this action is that this dilaton phi over here acts as a Lagrange multiplier, imposing the constraint that we're only studying a constant negatively hyperbolic 2 manifolds. And also what's important is that the matter sector over here, that the matter fields only talk to the gravity fields through the metric and not the dilaton. So the matter fields are minimally coupled to JT gravity. So the first thing you might want to compute is just the disk partition function, which I've depicted here. So this blue boundary here, this wiggly blue boundary, is the asymptotically ADS boundary. And we basically take Dirichlet boundary conditions for the metric and the dilaton. We fix both the metric and the dilaton to infinity, but then we keep their ratio fixed in a way that determines a parameter beta, which you can think of as a renormalized length of the boundary. But it also has the interpretation of being the inverse temperature of a partition function of a putative boundary dual theory. And furthermore, we can also insert matter operators on this blue ADS boundary. And these insertions are going to be dual to insertions of boundary operators, which I'll call O sub I, in the putative boundary dual theory. And I is just some index that labels different matter operators. OK, so that's the Euclidean description of the theory. Now we want to move to a Lorentzian description of the theory. So we just want to quantize this theory on the spatial interval times time with two asymptotically ADS2 boundaries. So first, let's just forget about the gravity for a second and just talk about an arbitrary QFT quantized on global ADS2. Here's the metric. And so as you know, states in the Hilbert space of this theory, which I'll call H0, can be prepared using half of the Euclidean hyperbolic disk. So here, this is half of the Euclidean hyperbolic disk, and this red dot reflects the insertion of a matter operator. And the point is that we should think of this as preparing a state on a Cauchy surface, and so this half disk is represented by a ket, and then we could also represent a bra with a half disk that's kind of reflected over this Cauchy surface, and then the inner product of the bra and the ket is given by gluing the two halves together, and it's this will give you an inner product that's guaranteed to be, you know, positive definite, or at least positive by reflection positivity, and what I'm describing is just the usual GNS construction of the Hilbert space in QFT. So it turns out that in JT gravity with matter, you could also do this GNS construction. It goes through in almost the same way, but it's a little different. So again, the way that we prepare states is just by taking the disk path integral and cutting it in half. And so here I've depicted one of these halves over here. So on this horizontal boundary over here, I'm going to fix boundary conditions for the matter fields, but I'm also going to fix boundary conditions for the metric. And the boundary condition for the metric is that we say that the extrinsic curvature of this boundary is 0. And we also fix the length of the boundary. That's why I put this parameter L here, although L is actually a renormalized length. So the length is infinity, but we can keep track of the length using this parameter L. Furthermore, on this boundary over here, we put the usual ADS boundary conditions where we specify, you know, the amount of Euclidean time evolution on the left and the right of this matter operator that I've inserted. And of course, it's important that I've inserted the matter operator on the boundary and not just somewhere in the bulk, just because of, you know, diff invariance. I have to, you know, specify the location of the operator, matter operator related to the boundary. Okay, so this is how I can prepare a state in the Hilbert space. And the point is that if I take two copies of this, then I can integrate over the matter fields, just as I did here, but also I have to integrate over this length. And that's how I glue the two half disks together to give us the disk path integral of JT gravity. And so I have to integrate over matter boundary conditions and also this parameter L. And so this basically means I'm doing a sum over basis states, if you will, in a Hilbert space given by H0, the Hilbert space of the QFT, times L2 of R, or square integrable functions of L. And so the Hilbert space of JT gravity plus matter is very closely related to the Hilbert space of just the matter. The point is we should think of H0 as describing the state of quantum fields on a Cauchy slice. And the Cauchy slice has a length L, which itself is a dynamical variable, and that gives us this extra tensor factor here. Okay, so now I've described the Hilbert space. Now let's talk about some operators that act on the Hilbert space. So the first operator of interest will just be, say, the ADM Hamiltonian, suppose the right Hamiltonian. So I'll define it just by telling you how it acts on these, you know, half disk states. So if I'm given a state that's prepared using the Euclidean path integral like this, then by definition, if I act on it with e to the minus beta hr, this gives you the same thing, except now I increase the amount of Euclidean time evolution by beta on the right-hand side. So now I've defined this operator on, you know, a dense subspace of the whole Hilbert space, or equivalently just the whole Hilbert space. Likewise, I can also define a matter operator over here, which I'll call O, or OR, R, because I'm defining it on the right boundary. So again, if I start with this state over here, all I do is I insert a matter operator at the very right endpoint of the Cauchy slice, or in this corner over here. And so just by drawing these pictures, I can define the Hamiltonian and the matter operator on the right. And similarly, I could do the same thing on the left side. So I have OR, HR, and then OL, HL. And of course, the right operators commute with the left operators. And from these, you know, pictorial definitions, I could give you actual equations or expressions for these operators acting on the Hilbert space that I mentioned earlier. But for this talk, I won't need it. So I'll just refer you to the paper if you want to see those. Okay, so now I've defined the Hilbert space, I've defined some operators of interest, now let's use these operators to make algebras. Good, so yeah, we can define a von Neumann algebra by first defining a star algebra and then taking its double commutant. So I'm gonna let my star algebra, I'm gonna call it A, R, 0, and this is gonna be the star algebra of all the words I can make from the letters O and H. And again, this I index here just indexes multiple species of matter operators that we might be considering. And also, just because I want all these operators to be bounded, I'm going to insert some Boltzmann factors here. But basically, I'm just interested in simple operators that you can construct just, you know, out of the letters H and O. And so these are some examples. Okay, so that defines AR comma zero. So now to get a von Neumann algebra AR, I'm going to take the double commutant of AR comma zero. Equivalently, you could say that I'm taking the completion of the star algebra in the weak operator topology. And it's actually very important that I take this double commutant, as you'll see soon. So we should think of this von Neumann algebra as defining, you know, the algebra of observables that's accessible to an observer on the right boundary. And the definition of the left von Neumann algebra is completely analogous. Okay, good. So now I'll describe the main technical results of this work, and then I'll go on to describe their physical interpretation. But for the main technical result, well, let's see. So let's let this operator A, lowercase a, be in the commutant of AL. Then it turns out that one can write A as an infinite sum over operators in AR comma zero. And again, AR comma zero was used to generate the von Neumann algebra AR. So the point is that this sum over here, it converges when it's inserted in between any bra and ket. Or equivalently, you could say that this sum converges in the weak operator topology. And von Neumann algebras are supposed to be closed in the weak operator topology. So what this means is that if I have any operator in the commutant of the left algebra, this is contained in the right algebra. And so it's important that I completed AR comma zero to AR in order to make this statement. And then a more trivial statement to verify is that the right algebra is contained in the commutant of the left algebra. So what this means is that the commutant of the left algebra is equal to the right algebra. And then by taking the commutant of both sides of this, I can get this as well. So the two algebras are commutants of each other. So that was the first technical result. And then the second technical result is that these two algebras, AL and AR, are factors. All this means is that if you take the intersection of these two algebras, you get another von Neumann algebra, which is just the trivial algebra, just multiples of the identity operator. So yeah, so these two bullet points here are the two technical results of this work. And I'm not going to go into the proofs just for lack of time. But basically, the way to prove these things is just to take the explicit expressions for these operators and just look at the matrix elements of these operators in a basis that diagonalizes the energy. And once you do that, you find that the conditions, such as, you know, being in the commutant of AL, is so incredibly constraining that you're just forced to have an operator that is in the right algebra. So it's kind of interesting how that works out, but maybe for another time. So good. So now we have these two results. Now we can derive another statement here. So if you have any von Neumann algebra A, this equation is true. So let's take the intersection of A and its commutant, and then take the commutant of that. And this is equal to the union of A and its commutant, and then take the double commutant of that. So now we'll set A equal to AR. And what you find is that if you take the union of AR and AL, and then you look at the von Neumann algebra generated by that, this is actually equal to the commutant of the identity operator, which is just the type 1 algebra of all bounded operators on the Hilbert space. Okay, so now for the physical interpretation of these results. So first of all, these results are valid for any value of Newton's constant. So we're not just working in the semi-classical regime. Instead, we're quantizing the theory exactly in G Newton. So this means that space-time can be subject to huge quantum fluctuations. And as a result, the only way we can make sense of the entanglement wedge in this most general case is by using algebras, because we don't really have a notion of definite space-time here. So I'm going to say that AR is basically the algebraic definition of the right entanglement wedge, and AL is the same for the left entanglement wedge. So good. So this equation I copied from the previous slide. And so this equation physically means that any bulk operator, namely any operator in, you know, B of H, can be reconstructed from the union of the left and right CFTs. And this is what you might expect from semi-classical considerations as well. If you have access to both the left and right CFTs, you can reconstruct anything. And so basically, the algebra generated by AL and AR together is everything. Good. And then on the other hand, the operators in the right entanglement wedge will just be the operators in AR, and we know that the operators that generated AR are just the Hamiltonian and the single trace matter operators. So this means that the operators that you can reconstruct in the entanglement wedge, you can actually reconstruct just from the Hamiltonian and the single trace matter operators. And this resonates with the idea that modular flowed single trace operators are sufficient to reconstruct the entanglement wedge. So in other words, the operator that the unitary operator that implements the modular flow will be made out of the matter operators and the Hamiltonian. Hence, it's in the algebra that I'm calling the entanglement wedge. And that's essentially all you need. So I think there's a very strong case to be made that these algebras are the algebraic definitions of the entanglement wedges. OK, so now I've defined some von Neumann algebras. Now we want to ask, how do they fit into the classification of factors that we heard about in the previous talk? So to do this, I'll define a trace on the algebras. One guess that turns out to be correct for a trace you can define on this algebra is just to go back to the Euclidean path integral. So for example, let's consider the trace of e to the minus beta 1h, O, e to the minus beta 2h, O. So this operator here defines natural boundary conditions on the disk. Again, each of these O's just refers to a red dot on the ADS boundary. And so I'll just define the trace to be an abstract mapping from AR, 0 to number just given by evaluating this Euclidean path integral. And so this defines a trace on AR, 0, but we want to define a trace on the entire von Neumann algebra AR. So to do this, we're going to consider this expression, which also appeared in the Pennington-Wooden paper. So basically, let's take the expectation value of your operator in the Hartle-Hawking state, the state prepared by Euclidean evolution for some beta, and then take the limit where beta goes to 0. And so this expression, basically by definition, if A is an AR, 0, it gives you the Euclidean path integral. But now this is something that you could compute for anything in the von Neumann algebra, because it's really just an expectation value. So this will be our trace. And so the fact that this trace exists means that the algebra AR cannot be type 3. Meanwhile, the Hilbert space that I introduced earlier, H, it doesn't factorize according to the right and the left algebra. So this means that these algebras can't be type 1. So there's only one choice left, the algebra. These algebras have to be type 2, and they're factors, because I proved that before. And for factors, it turns out that the trace that I mentioned here is actually unique. This is just a general property of factors, that if they have a trace, it's unique up to an overall normalization. And furthermore, you can say that this is a type 2 infinity factor, because if you take trace of the identity operator, that just gives you infinity. OK, so once you accept that the trace is completely well-defined and unique, this means that the entropy is completely well-defined up to a state-independent additive constant. And so this is the way of computing entropies using von Neumann algebras that renders the replica trick completely obsolete. So in other words, if you prepare some state, say, using a Euclidean evolution, but maybe with a matter particle, like a matter operator inserted, its reduced density matrix would be in AR. In fact, it would actually be in AR, 0. And so once you have a reduced density matrix in the algebra, you can just compute minus trace rho log rho with the trace that we've constructed here, and that just gives you the answer. Or for the Renyi entropy, you could compute trace rho to the n, but n could be an integer or not an integer. It doesn't matter because, rho is just a bounded operator acting on a Hilbert space. You could raise the bounded operator to any power you want, and there are no subtleties in doing that. So instead of thinking about, the replica trick and replica symmetry, you can just compute the entropy using the von Neumann algebra. And actually, in this example, there is no replica symmetry because that's broken by the gravitons. Okay, so I said that there's a unique trace, but there are actually some other candidate traces that one could attempt to define, and it will be useful to do this. So for example, in the past, people have studied, JT gravity with defects. Like maybe you could put a conical defect inside the disk. and you could use this to define a trace. So again, we use the Euclidean path integral to define our trace, where you know the operator that you put in the trace. Where the operator that you put in the trace defines boundary conditions for the path integral, but now I can put a conical defect in the path integral, and it turns out that you can actually choose the defect so that this trace is positive, so it really does feel like a trace. And this, it turns out that this alternative trace, it can only be defined on AR comma 0, the dense subalgebra of AR, and it can't be extended to a trace on all of AR because that would contradict you know, the theorem that the trace is unique up to an overall normalization for a factor. But what this means is that, you know, the statement that the trace is unique really depends on the fact that you completed AR comma 0 to AR. So you really can't just work with the dense subalgebra AR comma 0. There's a big physical difference between that and AR, even though the difference might at first seem only mathematical. You know, you're just completing some algebra and some topology that might feel very abstract, but the difference between doing that or not is the difference between having a unique trace or having a trace that basically obeys all the other properties of a trace other than normality. Okay. So that was one trace to consider. Here's another trace that you might want to consider. So of course, with every Hilbert space, you always just get a canonical trace, which I'm going to denote with an uppercase T. So it turns out that if you take an element in AR and an element in AL, and then you take the product of those, and then take the trace of that using this capital T trace, this is always going to be infinity. And there's an interesting physical reason why this is the case. Basically, it's because this trace over here can be computed by a gravitational path integral on a double trumpet geometry. So here's an example. I just took some operators in AL comma 0 over here and some operators in AR comma 0 over here and threw them into the trace. And basically, roughly speaking, you can imagine, you know, if you start off with an interval, which is where you quantize the theory and then do some Euclidean evolution and take the trace, you might expect to get a cylinder topology. And so you have this cylinder or double trumpet path integral in JT gravity. The operator AL determines the boundary conditions on the left side, and the operator AR determines the boundary conditions on the right side. And so it turns out that this is actually always going to be infinity for two reasons. One reason is that you have to integrate over, you know, all the moduli, the geometric moduli of this double trumpet, and there's only one. It's just the size of the geodesic that wraps this double trumpet. And when that length goes to zero, the matter path integral diverges, and so this is always infinity. There's also a second reason why this is infinity, which basically has to do with the ambiguity in, you know, picking which geodesic between the left and the right boundary was the Cauchy slice that you started with. Because if you're given any geodesic, you can construct another geodesic that connects the same points by winding around multiple times, and all that has to be summed over. So this trace fails to be a suitable trace in the algebra because it always gives you infinity. Good. Okay, so now, so far, I've only talked about the bulk theory, JT gravity with matter. And I haven't said anything yet about how this theory can be embedded into a boundary dual theory, so I just want to make a few comments about that. So a nice discussion about this was given in a paper from about a year ago from Henry Lin. And so he discussed the bulk to boundary map of this theory. So in this case, the boundary theory is going to consist of two copies of the SYK model, in some appropriate limits. And so here's basically how the bulk to boundary map works. So first, you could start off with the beta equals zero Hartle-Hawking state in the bulk theory. And this is supposed to be dual to a maximally entangled state in two copies of the SYK model. And meanwhile, the right ADM Hamiltonian will be reconstructed by the right SYK Hamiltonian. And likewise, a matter operator on the right, you know, acting on the right boundary will be reconstructed by an operator in the SYK model, which we'll just call M. It turns out that M in the SYK model has the same definition as H in the SYK model, except that the random parameters that appear in the definition of M are statistically independent from those that appear in H. And with this basically definition of a bulk to boundary map, you can prove that it's isometric. So in particular, if you act on this beta equals zero state with some combination of HR and OR, then that's going to be mapped to acting on the maximally entangled state with the same combination of HSYK and MSYK. So this defines a map from the bulk to the boundary. And again, in the appropriate limits, this mapping from the bulk to boundary is an isometry. Okay, so basically, I kind of just said that, you know, there is a way in the appropriate limits to realize JT gravity with matter as a code subspace of two copies of the SYK model. So if that's true, then this equation should be true. So this trace over here is the trace over the code subspace, which I basically discussed on the previous slide. And if we're taking a trace over the code subspace, this better be less than the trace over the entire Hilbert space, which in this case would be the trace over, you know, the Hilbert space of the two copies of the SYK model, which takes this factorized form. So, you know, in the usual discussions of the SYK model, there's this parameter S0, which I've briefly mentioned before, which basically governs the order of magnitude of the partition function of the SYK model. So for each partition function, we have e to the S0. So in total, we have e to the 2S0. But meanwhile, on the previous slide, I told you that this trace always gives you infinity. So obviously, we can't have infinity less than e to the 2S0 unless one of the assumptions goes wrong. So of course, the way out of this, or one way out of this, is to note that, you know, the bulk to boundary map is an isometry, but only in the appropriate limit. And it would have to be, a limit in which this parameter S0 goes to infinity. But alternatively, you could say that if S0 is finite, then you can map the bulk into the boundary, but non-isometrically. So I think, you know, this divergence, this matter divergence in JT gravity that I mentioned earlier is something that I think has been bothering people for a while. And I think the proper way to interpret it is just the fact that, you know, when S0 is finite, you can't isometrically embed the bulk theory into the boundary theory. And so I think if we have a better understanding of how this non-isometric embedding works, it might allow us to say something more interesting about this kind of universal matter divergence that you get in JT gravity plus matter. So it would just be interesting to have a bulk explanation for why the left-hand side here has to be finite when S0 is finite. Okay, so this is my last slide. I'll just conclude with some comments. So, so we define some von Neumann algebra factors, AR, AL. They algebraically define the entanglement wedges, even in the non-semiclassical regime. And the main technical results of this work were to show that these two algebras are commutants of each other, and they're also factors. One thing I should say is that there's an analogous result that actually appeared in the math literature, but they were describing a related system, which I'll just call Q-deformed JT gravity plus matter. You could ask me more about it later, but there are analogous results in the math literature. So I think something that would be really interesting is to use these algebras to learn more about semi-classical physics. Of course, the first thing to do would be to arrive at the usual definition of the entanglement wedge, you know, the one that refers to the QES formula, by taking the semi-classical limits of AL and AR. Another question I'm interested in is, what if we instead considered JT gravity with one ADS boundary, and then the other boundary is an end-of-the-world brain? In this case, you might expect the algebra of boundary observables to be type 1, just because if you have access to the one ADS boundary, you have access to the whole system. So this is something that I haven't been able to show technically yet, but is an interesting question to consider. And then kind of as I mentioned in the last slide, if we study more carefully the embedding of the bulk into the boundary, it would be interesting to perhaps derive corrections to the bulk physics that would be, that would arise from having a finite S0. Okay, so with that, I'll thank you for your time.
All right, thank you for the nice talk. We have time for some questions. Mark?
Hi, nice talk. I was wondering, is there a limit here where you just get quantum field theory in the bulk picture? And then if so, do you think you can kind of recover this, you know, very detailed structure of type 3, a net of type 3 algebras that you would have in the bulk from the construction that you came up with?
Well, you should be able, so the question is, can you recover the usual algebraic description of quantum field theory on a curved space-time in the semi-classical limit? And I think the answer is yes, and that's basically because, you know, we kind of had to put in a quantum field theory into the construction. So we'll definitely be able to get one out in the semi-classical limit. because you know the Hilbert, because I said earlier the Hilbert space is the Hilbert space of a QFT times L2 of R. And so then the JT gravity dynamics and the semi-classical limit will kind of freeze the length mode to a classical solution, and then all that's left is just the Hilbert space of the QFT, and then that's just where the quantum. And then that's the part that stays quantum, whereas the JT gravity part just becomes classical. And then, yeah, you should recover all the type 3 algebras for the QFT in that case.
Can you see how, say, some local operator that would emerge in the bulk would be described in terms of this sitting, you know, how it would sit in this algebra that you're constructing?
So you're asking, how do we see how a local bulk operator can be reconstructed from the boundary kind of in this way? So in principle, it can, because this is sort of the content of these more abstract results. But in practice, I guess it's a little harder to do that. I mean, you know, I gave some intuition about how modular flow can be used to, you know, access the full entanglement wedge. So, I mean, that story is still there, but we've kind of, I guess, just codified it in a different way. I think that's still the basic story, though. Yeah.
All right, Daniel?
Yeah, so two quick comments. So you asked about what kind of bulk physics could help with, you know, at finite S-naught. So a way I like to think about that divergence is that it comes from the renormalized length operator being able to be infinitely big. Mm-hmm. But when S-naught is finite, there should probably be sort of an IR cutoff on how long the bridge can be, and that would regulate the trace by making the spectrum discrete instead of continuous.
Right.
The other comment was that you said that the replica trick is obsolete, but the replica trick actually computes that additive constant, so it knows more than these algebraic methods.
Yeah, in the sense that you're using the Euclidean path integral, and someone had to give S naught to you.
Yeah.
But yeah, the additive constant is S naught, so sure.
Yeah.
Okay, one more question, and then if the next speaker could also make their way down.
I had a question about the uniqueness of the trace.
About the?
The trace?
Yeah, the trace.
I was just curious how you knew the defect trace was, the first question is just to clarify which assumption goes wrong. I think you said normal.
Normal.
And then which, how did you know that one wasn't normal? Like, how do you know the defect trace isn't the right one? Question.
So how do I know that it's not normal? Well, that's the only assumption all the other assumptions I can basically show. And you can't have all the assumptions being true, or else you violate a theorem about traces being unique. So that's just the last assumption.
To rephrase, how did you show normal for the other trace then?
Oh, that's basically supposed to be a consequence of the fact that we're evaluating the trace as an expectation value of a state, and that's normal.
Okay, thank you.